This is an ABC podcast.
Hello, welcome to PM. I'm Linda Mottram. Tonight, Australia will not be following Italy's nationwide coronavirus lockdown. It's not necessary, we're told, unless there's more community transmission. But ahead of government stimulus, the economic impact from the coronavirus still spreads to the dramatic responses from Qantas and the University of Tasmania shortly. And an emergency medicine specialist warns Australia's already stretched hospitals will struggle if more healthcare workers fall ill with COVID-19.
We're in an environment where we are going to be exposed repeatedly. Do we have the surge capacity? I'm worried about whether we do or not. And I think most of us at the moment would be very concerned that we do not.
Well, the tension in the global coronavirus outbreak has circled back to where it began today. China's President Xi Jinping has for the first time visited Wuhan, where the virus first emerged last December. There, the spread of the disease has slowed, with people across China gradually returning to work. But Wuhan-like lockdown scenes are now the reality elsewhere. Italy has gone into total lockdown, and other countries from the UK to Israel are ramping up their responses to the virus spread. Will Australia eventually see mass self-isolation in a bid to contain COVID-19? Bridget Fitzgerald reports.
More than 100,000 people have been infected with coronavirus across China, and more than 4,000 have died. But most of the infected have recovered, and the rate of infections has slowed. However, as quarantine measures start to be lifted across China, other countries are cracking down. Italy has imposed emergency restrictions to try and contain coronavirus.
It was quite spooky, very quiet, a lot of people walking around looking a bit dazed, and more people with masks this week.
Anna Kay is an Australian woman living in a small Italian village near Siena in Italy's Tuscany region.
I do feel worried. Yeah, I'm not quite sure what will happen, but basically for the next month I'll be housebound. So, yeah, life won't be normal for a while, I expect.
Italy, with more than 9,000 confirmed cases of coronavirus and more than 400 deaths, is the second worst hit country after China. As part of its emergency conditions, people have been asked to stay home, restrict travel, and public gatherings have been banned. In the UK, the government will impose new quarantine guidelines where anyone with minor symptoms will be asked to stay at home. The Chief Medical Officer is Chris Whitty.
Everybody who has even minor respiratory tract infections or a fever should be self-isolating for 7 days afterwards. And this is going to be the next step. We have not yet reached that step, but we are going to be reaching that step in the really quite near future.
And as the number of confirmed cases of COVID-19 rise in New South Wales, Sydney doctor Kathy Hull, who herself has just spent 2 weeks in self-isolation after her Ryde Hospital colleague tested positive, says putting major population centres in quarantine, regardless of symptoms or contact, could stem the virus spread.
If we did something like that now, we could slow down the spread, and that we could slow down the rate of infection, which will give us time to get the plans and the preparations into place.
But Australia's Chief Medical Officer, Brendan Murphy, says a widespread shutdown of schools, hospitals and businesses isn't necessary.
Our advice is we're not at that stage. If we had more sustained community transmission, then we wouldn't hesitate to make recommendations about public gatherings, about schools and the like. But we're reviewing this every single day. We look at the epidemiology, we look at the pattern. Each of the state and territory health departments and I get together. And if there was a reason to make significant public event moves, as you suggest, we would do it.
Infectious disease expert Mary Louise McClaws says while the idea of mass quarantine has merit, it's not a practical solution.
I think it's a very interesting perspective, and if the numbers were starting to drop overseas and we didn't think that once those 14 days were up that we could then have more cases coming into the country. It's a highly effective method, but it would be a waste of time and energy and resources if we weren't keeping the borders safe.
But Australians are clearly concerned. The Health Minister, Greg Hunt, confirmed today that Australia's coronavirus hotline has already received 20,000 calls and extra staff will be added this week.
Bridget Fitzgerald with that report. Well, there's been a breather for the Australian stock market today, at least for now. After early falls, the market clawed back after the global financial after the bruising that was caused by the biggest one-day sell-off on US markets since the global financial crisis. Seeking to shore up the languishing Australian economy, the Prime Minister has been calling on small businesses to keep their staff on despite the health crisis. Rachel Mealy reports.
The Prime Minister has called for patriotism and perseverance from Australian businesses in the face of the virus threat.
Whatever you thought 2020 was going to be about, think again. We now have one goal together this year: to protect the health, the well-being and livelihoods of Australians through this global crisis, and to ensure that when the recovery comes, and it will, we are well positioned to bounce back strongly on the other side.
He's asked businesses to keep the wheels of the economy turning by keeping staff on and continuing to pay casual workers.
We need you to support your workers by keeping them employed. Hold on to your people because you will need them on the bounce back on the other side. Wherever possible, support them. Full-time, part-time, casual, including with paid leave, if they need to take time off during the course of the virus.
The federal government will release details about a stimulus package for the Australian economy in coming days. It's tipped to include one-off cash payments for some groups, including pensioners and small business owners. The Shadow Treasurer, Jim Chalmers, says the action needs to be significant.
Slogans won't get the Australian people and their economy through the worst impacts of the coronavirus. Only substantial action will do that. And it can't just be any kind of action. It needs to put a floor under falling confidence. It needs to be big enough and fast enough to make a genuine difference.
The Prime Minister's call to arms was barely over before Qantas announced it would reduce capacity by almost a quarter for the next 6 months. The airline will reroute some services and ground 38 of its aircraft. CEO Alan Joyce says the airline will do whatever it can to avoid making staff redundant, including cuts to executive pay packets.
We'll be asking management to take a cut. I'll be taking no salary for the rest of this financial year, and our senior leadership team will be taking a 30% drop in salary. So we'll be trying to pull every lever that we can to make sure that the group gets through this environment.
From big business to small, the sentiment is the same. Lauren Seiflett owns a beauty salon in Canberra, just down the road from Parliament House.
The threat it poses is we will lose customers, people will self-quarantine and then they'll stop coming to us.
She says she'll find it tough to follow the Prime Minister's request to keep her staff employed if she doesn't get financial assistance.
I don't know how a small business can possibly do it financially. We don't budget for casuals to have sick leave. And then we'll be double upping on our pay. So I'd have to get another casual in, then small wages. We've already dug deep for the bushfires, the drought, and Canberra got hit with the smoke pretty bad. So we don't physically have the money.
Unions have called on the federal government to compensate Australia's 3.3 million casual workers if they don't have sick leave and need to self-isolate for a fortnight. Industrial Relations Minister Christian Porter says the government will consider the request but has urged unions not to press for their own objectives amidst the crisis.
This is not the time for people to come in and back pocket out things they've always wanted to see and ask for them under the banner of a health response. This is the time to think sensibly right across all business and industry sectors in Australia.
The US president has also foreshadowed taking action to protect casual or hourly workers. He says he'll meet congressional Republicans tomorrow to discuss some major steps to help the economy tough out the coronavirus woes.
We're also going to be talking about hourly wage earners getting help so that they can be in a position where they're not going to ever miss a paycheck. We're going to be working with companies and small companies, large companies, a lot of companies.
Closer to home, the University of Tasmania says it's going to slash hundreds of the degrees and courses it offers, admitting it's financially unsustainable. The university says it has an over-reliance on China as a market for international education, and the ongoing threat posed by coronavirus was a key challenge.
Rachel Mealy with that report. You're listening to PM. I'm Linda Mottram. More on coronavirus ahead. And a bit later, one of the most storied military men of the long war in Afghanistan tells us it is unacceptable that a new US-Taliban agreement fails to protect women's rights. And he says Australia and others should raise their voices.
I would hope that the international community, of which Australia is an extraordinarily important part, would come together in a common voice to make it unacceptable to go forward with that intra-Afghan conversation without the rights of women being thoroughly protected in the outcome.
Retired General John Allen is our guest. Well, as coronavirus cases and the demand for testing both rise, with the number of confirmed cases going up to nearly 100, as we've mentioned, the South Australian health authorities have announced a new initiative. They're going to open a drive-through testing station for people with symptoms. Rhett Burney reports.
Adam Dennis recently returned from northern Italy, but he brought back more than souvenirs.
While I was there, I had cold sweats, coughing, and a bit of a fever. By the time I got back to Australia, it was just a bit of a cough, not a dry cough, but I was just a small cough.
The Sydney man reported his symptoms to New South Wales Health and says he was told to make a booking with his GP. 30 minutes before his appointment, the clinic called and told him not to come in, but to go to hospital for a COVID-19 swab test. But he didn't want to go there because he feared he'd encounter a waiting room full of people possibly sick with coronavirus.
So I just self-isolated. Lucky I can. I have the opportunity to be able to work from home, so my income won't be affected. So I'll be doing that.
So does Adam Dennis think health authorities have got it right when it comes to coordinating the response to COVID-19?
No. The response, is less than stellar.
This afternoon, Australia's Chief Medical Officer, Brendan Murphy, acknowledged things could be done better, especially when it comes to providing GPs and the public with the right information and access to testing.
I think everything was going very well until we had a big run on tests on the weekend, and that's caused a little bit of confusion, but we will make sure that that information is well out there in the minds of GPs.
Until now, states and territories were solely responsible for opening and operating testing clinics for coronavirus.
So there are clinics that have been set up by the state and territory health departments already in most capital cities. The Commonwealth is now setting up a range of additional ones in areas to complement those that have been set up by the State and Territory Health Services.
In South Australia, COVID-19 testing clinics have been opened at major hospitals, and tomorrow SA will open Australia's first drive-through testing clinic. The state's Chief Medical Officer, Nicola Spurrier.
You will need to have a GP complete a pathology request form, and we are taking bookings for that service, but it means that people don't have to get out of their car, that they can have their swab taken very easily.
Those swabs will be taken by pathology workers wearing masks and gowns. SA Health says that'll provide zero risk of infection to the staff taking the swabs. Drive-through clinics for COVID-19 testing have already been established in the UK and the USA.
Rhett Burney with that report. There's growing concern among some doctors about inconsistent messaging from health authorities about how to handle the coronavirus and about political obstacles. One senior specialist also says she's deeply concerned about Australia's surge capacity if medical workers start requiring quarantine in large numbers and need to be backfilled. Dr. Sarah Whitelaw is an emergency medicine specialist physician, and she's on the board of the Australian Medical Association. We spoke a short time ago.
I would say that there's an enormous number of people who are doing their best. Having said that, and working exceptionally hard to deal with a virus that has so many unknowns, and for whom or for which the information about is changing so incredibly rapidly, and for who we have so few people that have the multidisciplinary expertise required to interpret that information as it's coming through and translate it into guidelines that can be kind of enacted by all of us, the community and the healthcare system on the ground. Having said that, I would say that what we've seen, particularly over the last week and weekend, with the inconsistencies in messaging and public health messaging to both the community and the healthcare profession, has made things extraordinarily more difficult, and some would say more difficult than it needed to be, and put an extra challenge to us as Australia in facing this coronavirus that, you know, I think all of us would rather we didn't have to deal with.
Is it the case that we're simply missing an overarching authority that can take charge, like America has with the CDCs, for example?
What a fantastic suggestion. And in fact, the AMA has been calling for a national CDC now for over 10 years. And the expertise of a single centrally funded and coordinated agency to corral, as I talked about earlier, the necessary multidisciplinary expertise in this area is essential. And I think part of what we're seeing is the lack of having a CDC. I hope that one of the lessons that we learn from this experience is how valuable a CDC will be to us in the future, and I'm quite sure that lesson is being absorbed at the moment.
What are the implications in terms of trying to contain this virus, which is quite an urgent matter? What are the implications for that attempt when you've got differing messages coming from different state authorities, the federal authority and so forth?
My up close and personal, I guess, experience of the impact of that is the enormous burden that this is putting on the health system. From a practical perspective, to see the difficulties that GPs are facing and the sense that they feel like they have had a lack of communication, a lack of consultation and a lack of effective utilisation of what they can contribute is heartbreaking. I think the other interface is the interface between the community care, which is generally funded by the federal government. It's such an artificial distinction, and the fact that we wouldn't be, that we're trying to still deal with that separately in conditions of, you know, a threatened pandemic is just hampering us.
What happens if a lot of medical personnel start getting this virus? Do we have the capacity to fill their shoes, to backfill them?
I personally have no problem saying I'm deeply concerned about our surge capacity in the healthcare system to replace 40% of healthcare professionals. We culturally already feel an enormous pressure to work when we would otherwise not necessarily choose to be working because of the lack of surge capacity. When you add on to that the added pressures of something like COVID-19 on the system and the increase in number of patients, the increase in number of sick patients on the entire system, we're in an environment where we are going to be exposed repeatedly in a way that is different to not working as a healthcare worker. Do we have the surge capacity? I'm worried about whether we do or not, and I think most of us at the moment would be very concerned that we do not.
Dr. Sarah Whitelaw. And if you haven't had a chance to catch the new ABC podcast that's called CoronaCast, it is worth the effort. It answers your biggest questions about the coronavirus, and it's on the ABC Listen app or in the usual podcast places. A top US military figure is imploring Australia and other Western allies to actively insist on the protection of women's rights in Afghanistan after the signing of an agreement between the US and the Taliban last month. After 18 years of war, the agreement for bringing peace to Afghanistan is supposed to lead to talks between the Taliban and the Afghan government. But the US declined to make women's rights a priority in a deal that many say is deeply flawed in many ways. Retired four-star US General John Allen, who was the commander of all US and NATO forces in Afghanistan between 2011 and 2013, says the future of Afghan women is the overriding concern. General Allen, who is also an Order of Australia recipient, is now the president of the Brookings Institution in the US. He is part of our conversation.
Look, it's almost impossible for the Taliban to remain committed to their cause and be committed ultimately to the rights of women. So beyond the fact that the agreement does not require the Taliban to make definitive commitments, beyond the fact that the agreement has created an environment which puts the Ashraf Ghani government in a difficult situation with respect to the 5,000 detainees that it holds, I think that the agreement is unacceptable, because the United States should have set the conditions for an international standard for the treatment of women in the aftermath of this agreement. And I'll stop there.
The question of women is, as you say, so pivotal, and it has been such a huge international cause. Is that going to be the thing in the end, apart from all of the other complexities and shortcomings in this deal, will that be the thing that brings this undone? Because surely Afghan women will not allow a government of theirs to negotiate away their rights with the Taliban.
I would hope that the international community, of which Australia is an extraordinarily important part, I would hope the international community would come together in a common voice to make it unacceptable for this agreement to go forward. The final, what's known as the intra-Afghan agreement, to go forward with that intra-Afghan conversation without the rights of women being thoroughly protected in the outcome. You know, it's a very real condition that the state of Afghan women's rights and the state of Afghan civil society, women in civil society, is a direct result in many respects because of the sacrifices of Australian and American troops. We worked very hard to give the Afghan women a sense of prominence in their society, and we paid a big price for that. It would never have happened in the Afghan government as it exists today, and it would certainly never have happened under the Taliban. And so we have to have a common coalition voice, an international voice, that seeks to create the conditions under which the Afghan women, their rights and their future will be guaranteed by any peace agreement that emerges from this current set of talks.
Do you see any evidence of moves towards that international coalition to ensure the status of women is maintained? Is anybody actually moving on that front to bring that together?
No, I don't see it as a priority for the United States. In fact, senior American leadership were very dismissive when they were asked the question about what about Afghan women. And the comment was, well, let's leave this for the Afghans to figure out. Well, I don't think we should leave this for the Afghans to figure out. And I would hope that NATO would have a voice in this. I would hope that key states like Australia and the Nordic countries that have always been champions for women's rights, I would hope that Canada would have an important role in this. And the EU, those are countries, those are organizations that have always been highly biased on behalf of women's rights more broadly in the world, but very specifically biased towards women's rights in Afghanistan. And I think that their voices should be heard right now. And that may, in fact, ultimately be the impetus to bring the United States on board to get serious about any kind of a final outcome in Afghanistan guaranteeing women's rights.
And, of course, we still see two claimants to the leadership of the country in Afghanistan after the elections last year. You know, that rivalry between Ashraf Ghani and Abdullah Abdullah is not new. The US is again having to try to broker some deal to get a settled government.
Yes.
I mean, without a settled government, this can't proceed to the next phase anyway, can it?
Well, it'll be difficult. I think we have to resolve this in order for there to be this sense that Afghanistan can move forward with a coherent, public-facing government, with a sense that the government will follow Ashraf Ghani to to give him the power, the inherent power necessary to move forward with the negotiations with the Taliban. But it's not clear at all to me that we should have any expectation that the Taliban will ever be able to honor this agreement. So in many respects, I think it's a false hope.
General John Allen, thank you very much for your time today.
Thank you very much.
Retired US General John Allen, and there's a more in-depth conversation at the PM webpage. Well, there's been a huge spike in complaints to banks about mortgages. The Australian Financial Complaints Authority says they're up by 20% in recent months. Financial counsellors on the front line of debt distress say it coincides with more and more Australians seeking help to buy day-to-day items like food. Our business reporter David Taylor has the story.
Hello, good afternoon. National Debt Helpline, Sydney. How can I help you?
Calls from Australians in financial distress are coming in thick and fast at the National Debt Helpline.
Okay, there's MoneyCare at Campbelltown. They can help you there. And I can give you their telephone number and you can make an appointment. Because, you know, bankruptcy is the last resort. Yes, it's very important to check all this out.
Here, financial counsellors field calls from borrowers who have been wrangling with their bank and don't know where else to turn.
We've been seeing a steady increase in mortgage stress for the past 2 years. So we saw a 10% increase in 2019 compared to 2018. And if 2020 continues the same way, it'll be another 10% increase this year.
The National Debt Helpline will often refer borrowers in distress back to their banks to find a solution. That's seen a massive 20% spike in mortgage complaints to banks in recent months, according to the Australian Financial Complaints Authority. The complaints range from banks not responding to initial requests for assistance, confusion around loans converting from interest only to principal and interest, and issues with responsible lending. Justin Untersteiner is the Chief Operating Officer at AFCA. He says it's become obvious there's been a spike in Australians suffering debt distress.
I think there could be a range of different reasons. You know, sometimes it could be a person's personal circumstances. You know, they could have lost a job or they've had a change at home. You know, other times it could just be general pressure that they're facing. So, look, I think there's a range of reasons for it. But again, our message is it is important for consumers to contact the financial firm first to see what they can do. And if they don't have any success, they can contact the Australian Financial Complaints Authority and lodge a complaint with us. Our service is free and it's simple to use, and we can then work with the financial firm and the consumer to find the right outcome.
It's clear that debt and financial distress are behind a big increase in mortgage complaints. But it's also clear that well over a year after the conclusion of the Banking Royal Commission, the banking sector still has a long way to go to rebuilding community trust.
Look, I think overall we're seeing a positive response from the banks and financial firms. Again, though, what we are asking from the banks and financial firms is to make sure that they work closely with their customers who are seeking assistance, make sure that they look into their circumstances to find the best way to support them to get the best outcome for the customer and consumer as well as the bank. Sometimes what we're seeing is on the surface some goodwill in that we're seeing customers provided hardship arrangements, so extensions on repayments, but often it's for short periods of time, such as 3 months, where if someone's lost their job, they might need 6 or 12 months to get back on their feet. So we're really asking firms to take a closer look with their customers and make sure they tailor a response to their customer needs.
The National Debt Helpline's Karen Cox is calling for banks to lift their game as more Australians move below the poverty line.
What's particularly worrying is we spoke to about 40 people last year who were in the very final stages of the home repossession process. So they're people who have gone right through the court system. A lot of people give up and sell long before that. We've already spoken to 18 people facing notices to vacate that final stage of the process this year. If that continues, it could be 90 or more people ringing us this year about the final stage of the home repossession process.
Karen Cox, you were a witness during the very early stage of the Banking Royal Commission. Are you satisfied with the progress that the financial services sector has taken so far in terms of working through the issues that needed to be worked through to leave customers in a better off position?
Look, I think there's a lot of really goodwill. There's a lot of work being done, but they're big ships and they take a long time to turn around.
Financial Rights Legal Centre CEO Karen Cox with David Taylor. I'm Linda Mottram. That is PM for today. You can always find us at the ABC Listen app and wherever you get your podcasts. That's where you should subscribe and leave us a review too. AM and The World Today are also there, so subscribe to them and leave them a review as well. Talk to you next time.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.
Hi, I'm Stephen Stockwell.
And I'm Ange Lavoie-Pierre, and we're from the ABC's daily news podcast, The Signal.
There are a lot of lies getting around about coronavirus. The big, the small, the ridiculous, and the scarily believable. And some that are just straight up dangerous.
So how has misinformation about COVID-19 carved its way through the world? And can we contain it? Look for The Signal on the ABC Listen app or wherever you get your podcasts.